Hey everyone, if you'd like to support this podcast, you can easily do that by going to audibletrial.com/skiffyinfanti, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership, get a free audiobook, and you actually help us out by sending a little money our way. So go on and go do that and support this podcast. And we hope you enjoy listening to us babble for a whole hour.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the crow forgot one thing. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 108.
Back from our vacation on Ballybran, where we contracted alien butt parasites.
Wait, what planet?
Ballybran.
The hell is that?
I don't remember, but it's from a science fiction novel. I just don't remember
you,
which.
You just like Googled random fictional planets and picked the one that was impossible to pronounce?
Anne McCaffrey, yes.
Okay, thank you.
In The Crystal Singer. There you go.
All right, I'm
also
Sean.
Also Telechandra and Crystal Line and other novels by her. I'm Jen.
And we have two guests today. We have Julia Rios and Stina Light. Welcome to the show, you two.
Hello.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, briefly, why don't we talk about you two? I'm pointing as though you can tell who I'm pointing at, which is ridiculous. Well, first, let's start with Julia. You are, of course, part of Outer Alliance. You're like the big head honcho of Outer Alliance.
Well, I'm not the big head honcho. The person who founded it is Natanya Baron. But I do host the Outer Alliance podcast.
That's pretty big and head honcho-y.
I suppose so. I'm also a fiction editor at Strange Horizons.
Oh, that's right.
That's more head honcho-y. That's very, it's very official. I crush the dreams of aspiring writers over breakfast.
Yeah, you crush mine
that
a lot.
That must be fun.
It's really horrible because I thought, you know, I don't actually do that. And then I had Leah Bobbitt staying at my house, and she's, of course, the editor of Idiomancer. And she was sitting across from me at my dining room table one morning, and I was eating breakfast, and I was reading some stories and sending some rejections. And I mean, I hate to do it. I really do hate to send rejections. It has to be done. But it's awful feeling like, you know, you are putting a little bit of evil into someone's day. But as I was doing it, I suddenly had this moment of realization where I was like, I'm eating cereal in the morning and rejecting story. I really am crushing the dreams of aspiring writers over breakfast. And Leah told me she usually waits till lunch, so apparently I'm especially evil.
That is pretty rough. Yeah, you'll be rejecting many of mine, so don't worry. But I promise you won't crush my dreams, though. I'll be persistent.
Yeah, please don't take it personally. It's never a personal thing against you as the writer. It is always just a case of there are so many stories out there and we can only choose a very few of them.
Yep. That's the way it works. Just in case any, but I've got like 150 rejections. So I'm on my way to towards my Bradbury 800. So, that's my plan. 800 rejections and then a pro sale. Yeah.
Go, Sean.
I prefer just maybe like a pro sale before 200, if we could make that. I think I would lose a piece of my soul at the 800 mark with how slow I write. So, but anyway, so, all right. So, and then, of course, we have Stina Light, who's like an author or whatever, who wrote some books or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I heard that.
Yeah. Are you sure? Maybe she didn't. What did you do?
I wrote A Blood and Honey and Blue Skies from Pain. Oh. And I'm up for a Campbell Award. I'm a Campbell Award nominee. And I was shortlisted for the Crawford Award. And that's it. I do a terrible job at introductions. But there you are.
Basically, you just came on here because you wanted to brag about how awesome you are.
Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome.
Didn't you beg, Sean?
I feel so much better.
No, well, you wrote two great books when we interviewed you for both. So, just saying.
Yes, because you're marvelous.
Well, if you keep writing books, you'll keep being on this show. Hint, yay! Hint. Wink, wink. So.
Wow, I needed some motivation to carry on. Now I know I can.
Good. If we're your only motivation for continuing to write books, I think we have succeeded as a show. Yes.
Either that or Stina's life is a little bit sad.
But okay, so anyway, so we have two topics today. Our first topic is more the big announcement of the week, which is that The Hobbit is now going to be a trilogy. Who's clapping? Who the heck is clapping?
That's me. I'm excited.
Okay, we're going to have disagreement. This is going to be good. So let's just start with this general, like a general sense of how we feel about that. The fact that this, what was going to be one movie, then became two movies, and now is going to be three movies based on one book. Why don't we start with Jennifer, since she seems so excited.
Well, for one thing, it's not based on one book. Granted, it started out that way, but they're expanding it to include stories from the Silmarillion and whatnot.
Really?
So, yes, that's essentially why they're doing it, because The Hobbit was not, I mean, yeah, it was a standalone novel, but it was expanded on. Bilbo Baggins' story was, you know, enriched by the Silmarillion, and I think it was in another one of his releases as well, but the Silmarillion for sure. So that I think is fantastic. The fact that, let's just be honest, Lord of the Rings as a trilogy, it could have been six movies easily, and in some ways I wish it had been. So the fact that they're expanding The Hobbit, which to me was, I'm The Hobbit is my more beloved book. So I'm glad. I'm excited that he's going to be able to expand on it and show how wonderfully amazing this world really is. And that's good.
Okay.
What?
I'll save my opinions. What about you, Julia?
I'm pretty ambivalent about it, actually. I'm planning to see the movies, and I will see them however many of them there are. And I've seen a lot of people be either super, super angry or super, super happy about this. I have not really seen anyone say, like, eh. I don't really mind. I don't really mind either way. I figure that, of course, if the movie producers think that they can make money, if the studios think that they can make money off of it, they'll stretch it out for as long as possible to make more money. I do think that Peter Jackson probably is coming at it from the point of view of being just super geeked out about doing the Tolkien movies. I think he really loves the source material and is a big fan. So, you know, I thought the original Lord of the Rings movies, there were good points and bad points. I didn't think they were the best movies ever. There were things that I really liked about them, though.
I totally agree with that. I was not. I'm still not a big
says the
fan.
Person who was like, they could have been six and I would have been happy.
No, they could have been. I honestly think that there were things that were left out that I really wish had been in there. And that's why I say I wish it had been six, because I think that there were some edits that I was like, not a big fan of that edit. And
I was not a big fan of some of the things that they added to give the women something to do, but
that too.
But you know, and there were a couple of choices that weren't the best choices in the world that they did with Aragorn, and Faramir. They totally messed up Faramir.
Yeah,
but,
a lot.
Oh my God. Okay. But that said, I mean, I've been a huge Tolkien fan for a majority of my life. I own all of the books, all of them. I've read the Silmarillion multiple times. I love the Silmarillion. Me and four other people, probably. I'm very excited that they're going to take material from it and place that into the films. When I initially heard about it, I was like, three movies? Really? Three? I mean, I could see two, maybe, but three? But I don't care, as long as they do a good job, you know? And I feel like The Lord of the Rings films had some problems, but mainly I'm really, really pleased with them, because overall, I believe that Jackson honestly loves the books. He's a huge fan. He's a Tolkien fan, you know, and he did it of course, there was, you know, lots of money involved, mind you, but he did it with the eye of someone who loves them. You know what I mean? He didn't do it just for the money. He did it because he loves the story. So I want to see it done with the same motivation. You know what I mean?
Right.
And as long as that attitude is present, I don't mind. I mean, they can continue on until they go through all 12 of the books of Tolkien's notes. I don't care.
Would that be fun, though? I would pay to see those movies.
I would too. You and me both. I mean, there'd be two of us in the theater, but
probably.
So we have one super enthusiastic, one who is mostly enthusiastic, one ambivalent, and then me who's going to hate on it.
That's because you're evil.
Mostly I'm just doing it because I want to be a contrarian. So, yeah.
It's a dirty job. Somebody's got to do it. Usually it's me. Go at it.
I guess my problem with it is that having seen him work with other materials, I worry that this is going to end up being a series of very bloated movies. I'm speaking in particular of King Kong, which I didn't think was as horrible a movie as some people said. I thought it was pretty good, but there are definitely points in that movie where it drags and drags. It feels almost like when you watch the extended editions of Lord of the Rings, which are great, but there was no way they could have released those as general films, as feature films. They had to put them on the DVDs. And that's my concern with The Hobbit. Because now we're inserting this third movie, but what exactly are we going to add to a story that, compared to Lord of the Rings, is a fairly simple story?
Well, it's not just simple. It's actually, it's really tightly written. And he won't be able to add anything to it. To the basic book, but the Silmarillion just has stories that are like his adventures beyond the Lonely Mountain. You know, that's.
But are they going to be able to provide that? I haven't read the Silmarillion, so excuse me. The experts will have to clarify. Can they make this third film into a separate, like with Lord of the Rings, with the third film actually brought everything to some kind of a giant close? There was a big, enormous climax. Can they still do that? Because otherwise, what's the point? Otherwise, it's not really a trilogy. It's three separate movies that are all vaguely in the same world, with two of them being part of the same story and one of them separate.
Yeah, I mean, the Silmarillion, by the way, is not just about Bilbo Baggins and the Hobbits.
Okay? No. It's only a couple of the stories are.
Yes. Right. I mean, it's all of the background material. It's about the mythology of the world. It's all of this stuff that, I mean, I'd be fine if they started off, if they made the Silmarillion movie in a way and took several of the stories out of that and then made the whole creation myth and just took it from there, right? And then went to The Hobbit and then make it three movies and then have that one be like the, I don't know, the pre-movie movie. I don't know. But I don't know. Well, where was I going?
I think I'm that sorry. Based on the release statement, it sounds like they're basically doing that.
Yeah.
They're taking all of the source material and sort of trying to make it into one large narrative that spans three movies.
Yes.
But it's drawing on all the different material. So I have no idea. I'm kind of interested to see what happens, but I don't have a whole lot of investment in it either way, except that I expect it'll probably be pretty.
Right.
Well, if nothing else, it will be pretty.
Because it's going to be more New Zealand and Hobbit houses and awesomeness.
And Martin Freeman.
Yay. And Martin Freeman, who is... That gave me more hope than anything, I think, when I saw that they had cast him as Bilbo.
I will tell you, one thing that makes me more hopeful for this than for other things is that there is actually source material there. There's something that they are working from. It already exists, and this is not going to be the Star Wars prequels.
Oh my god. What prequels? I don't know what you're talking about.
The first one exists, but the other two don't.
No.
No.
They just don't exist. Not
none of those exist.
No, I agree. I mean, there, I think it can be said, there can be the criticism of, oh, you know, maybe this is just a money grab. Hopefully that's not all he's doing this for. It's probably one of his motivations. It's certainly the motivation of the production company to put their money into it, though.
Yeah, I mean, that always is.
However, as a director, he's probably going, look, if I have the opportunity to keep making this story, this wonderful story, this, you know, beloved stories into movies, and if people are going to give me money for it, then why not take the opportunity and go for it? I have a feeling that the narrative will probably be the Hobbit book will probably be 1.5 of the films. Mm-hmm. And then the second 1.5 films will be the stories from the Silmarillion. But it is there and back again. So there's going to have to be some of the back again.
Yeah. But for me, it should be part of the first half of the first movie should be the Silmarillion. So that you know who these people are, right?
And that probably won't happen.
No, because they've already filmed pretty much everything for the actual Hobbit.
Yeah, that's done. And it's this, unless this is like a sneak decision that they made ages ago and just never mentioned, I have a feeling that the first film will pretty much just be The Hobbit, and probably most of the second film. Although it would be nice to have that backstory, I don't see how this late in the game they could be doing it. You know, it's coming out in, 5 months?
I don't know.
Well, maybe they planned this like 8 months ago.
Exactly.
You know, and they just never told anyone.
That would be awesome.
Don't count on it though.
No, I'm not counting on it at all.
Well, I generally don't have a whole lot of faith in Hollywood, but I'm hoping.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
I'm going to take the kids to see it, and then I suddenly have this, like, because we have the next, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, we've got it sitting in our Netflix looks. We're like, we're going to have to watch it, and then I'm like, wait a minute, maybe you should wait. We'll just wait until after The Hobbit is done, and then you can go watch all the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah!
You know, I got to introduce it. I mean, both of my kids have read The Hobbit. One of them has read half of the Lord of the Rings. I don't think she finished it, but... I'm like, it's time. Turn you into pure geeks.
Well, they are pretty big geeks, so.
They are pretty big geeks, that's true.
Alrighty, so why don't we move on then to our sort of impromptu question topic, which is, excuse me. Our question is this, where does genre go once it becomes the dominant medium of storytelling?
I want Julia's thoughts on this, only because she thought it was a part of one greater topic. And I was wondering where she was going with that.
Well, I was thinking about that as sort of the trend that we've seen in recent years for longer and longer movies and more sequels and prequels, because suddenly genre has become this huge thing. It's in demand, and you have 7 Harry Potter movies that have become 8 Harry Potter movies, and 3 Twilight movies that have become 4 Twilight movies, and 1 Hobbit movie, which is now 3 Hobbit movies. And so I thought, oh, well, you know, when genre becomes one of the dominant things, what we do is stretch it out more and more. And we have John Carter of Mars, which was a monumental box office flop. Because they put hundreds of millions of dollars into that, and they are not recovering that.
No, they advertised that like crap. They did a terrible advertising job.
Yeah, I think the marketing department failed. I mean, my...
They spent a ton of money on the marketing, though. I mean, they marketed that. They spent a lot. They spent way more than they spend on a lot of other movies.
Really? Because I didn't even notice. I mean, I haven't even seen the film in question because I felt like the previews were so bad.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was part of it, but I think a lot of it was, I don't think the American public is ready for that type of science fiction.
Hmm.
What do you mean?
To an extent. I mean, we're ready for things like Aliens, although the Aliens prequel sucked. So.
Yeah, Prometheus was terrible.
Stina, I hear, likes it, but...
There are aspects of it that I liked. I will not say that I thought it was the most fabulous film in the world, but it was not the worst film I ever saw, either.
But we don't have a lot of, you know, sort of golden age science fiction made into films, modern films. And I think this sort of combination of fantasy with science fiction that in some ways marks John Carter, at least in terms of vision, imagining. I'm not sure if that's something that at least Americans are willing to put their money into.
And there's where I'm going to disagree.
Yeah, I have to disagree with that. I think that if you do it well, if you tell a tight story and it's engaging, and you can just win anybody. Because before Harry Potter came out, people said that we didn't want fantasy books for children.
And, well, so much for that.
I mean, before Twilight was
well,
big,
I disagree.
Every book was not a vampire or werewolf book.
I know, but also most of children's books were fantasy on some level or another. I mean, a lot of them. Yeah.
Bestsellers, though. I mean, that changed it. That changed everything.
Yeah.
From Harry Potter and Twilight both really changed the way bookstores were laid out. In the past few years, if I go into a bookstore, there is YA, and then there's YA science fiction and fantasy.
Yes, and that having been a bookstore employee for 6 years, there's a reason for that. Yeah.
And the reason is that it's in huge demand, and there's tons of it. And when I was a kid, I was looking for that stuff really hard, and there wasn't as much.
It didn't even exist, as far as I knew. There were the little kids' books, and then there were the adult books. There wasn't anything specifically marketed for in between.
Yeah.
So I started reading adult books when I was 12 because that's what was available, as far as I knew. But
I don't know.
The interesting thing is, I saw Dark Crystal last night.
I love that movie.
It is the worst film, but it is the prettiest film at the same time. I don't blame
exactly.
you for loving it. I mean, it's very pretty. And if you keep in mind that all of the scenery that's eating each other and stuff is all made of puppets, you begin to realize the sheer amount of work that was involved in putting that thing together and how beautiful it really is. But the writing is just terrible.
Horrible.
Oh my god, it's awful.
What the hell is going on in that plot?
Who knows?
I haven't seen it in so long.
But the really interesting thing about it is that, and this is something that Jeremy... Whoops.
Sorry, that would be the cat.
Oh, okay. The really interesting thing that Jeremy Lassen brought up when he was watching it, he said that the whole beginning part of it, where the narrator is not trusting the audience to understand what's happening. The narrator is saying, yes, the crystal is floating. I mean, can't you see that the crystal's floating on the screen? I mean, you can see it.
Obviously not, Gina. I mean, come on.
But yeah, but the deal was is that this film, when it was made, they didn't trust audiences to understand enough, to have enough of a vocabulary to understand what was happening on the screen. They had to hold... They felt they had to hold the audience's hand throughout the whole thing. Now, I saw it back then, and I don't remember noticing that quite as much as I do now. And I'm not sure. I mean, I've always been a science fiction fantasy fan. Wow. There goes the cat again?
Yes, the cat. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering about that. I mean, how do you... Do you all have similar memories or not?
I was a big... The books that I read as a kid that were, to me, YA, or as close to YA as I could get in terms of fantasy, was The Neverending Story and The Princess Bride and The Last Unicorn, things like that. So I always felt like, maybe because my dad was out there and he was finding them and then he was throwing them at me or what... but as a kid, I always felt like they were there, and so I understood it. I always kind of had that understanding. And there weren't a lot of films at the time, but the ones that were there, like The Neverending Story, Dark Crystal, and all these other ones, I don't know, maybe we did need hand-holding, and none of us realized it until, like you said, we got older and went back and we're like, wait a minute, because they were easing us into this.
Right, and because there's a second instance when you think about the Dune movie.
Oh, major hand-holding.
But these are both examples of movies that are things that people consider bad movies. I mean, that's not true. That anyone's going to say that the actual physical puppets and scenery in The Dark Crystal is bad, but I know very few people who would say that the movie itself is a good movie.
Right. That's very true. Same could be said.
And the Dune movie is notoriously a bad movie. No matter how much you like Frank Herbert or David Lynch, it's a bad movie.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain cuts that are better than others, yes.
But you know what's a good movie and what didn't actually ask us to be very, very hand-holdy? Blade Runner.
Oh my god, I love that.
True.
So...
But which version of Blade Runner? Which version?
Does it matter?
Yes, because some of the versions, the original version includes a really awful monologue at the end and other kinds of bad examples of movie making. Whereas the later editions, like I think there's a special cut, and then there's a director's cut, and then there's like the director's final cut, and then I'm sure there's a final cut in the making now. Those took out a lot of those issues. The original Blade Runner, I mean, I don't know if any of us were around. Jen might have been. She's 112, but...
Whatever. Oh, Christina's older than I am, you bastard.
I was certainly around.
But did you see it in theaters?
Yes, I did. I absolutely did. I was working in the movie theater at the time.
And you remember the really bad monologue at the end? Internal monologue?
I don't exactly remember.
Here's the thing, though. Not a lot of hand-holding with the film that came out, even the beginning one. But...
A little bit.
A ton of cutting from the original story. So in that sense, they still were... holding our hand. They were easing us into it. It's nowhere near as crazy.
I don't think cutting from the original story is necessarily a bad thing. I think
agreed.
I think that anytime you're making a movie, you're making it into something completely different anyway.
Yes, because it's not novels and film are not the same media. It's not the same kind of storytelling. So I agree with you.
Right, there's certain things that have to be done to the plot. You can't, like a novel's plot, if you converted that into a film, it would be the longest meandering plot imaginable.
Well, hence Dune, which...
Right, which is the problem you run into when you deal with texts that are incredibly complicated, like Lord of the Rings or like Dune, in which the authors have put an immense amount of effort into creating a real-feeling world. Is how do you then translate that to a film? Well, with Lord of the Rings... They wanted to cram it into, what was it, like one film at first, and like he haggled for two, and then they wouldn't take it at two. So, and then finally, New Line thankfully actually let him do three. But can you imagine trying to cram those three books into two films? I mean, it would be impossible. I mean, you couldn't even really technically do it in three films in a sense to take, they still had to cut so much out of it. But that's just kind of how the medium works. It requires that snipping out of what becomes unnecessary information for a film.
Certain things are gripping in a novel that wouldn't be gripping on the screen.
Right, and particularly things like, you know, like the emotion that would be played out in a novel. I mean, when you're reading it, you're inside of a character's head. Well, there's no way to do that with a film. I mean, unless you did some like weird avant-garde thing where you actually went inside someone's head, like being John Malkovich or something.
Or you just have constant internal monologue?
Oh no, hell no! Oh gosh!
But wouldn't the Twilight Breaking Dawn wedding that was 45 minutes long be better?
Oh my god!
If you had internal monologue the whole time?
No, it would be even worse because the only thing that would be going on in that character's head is, I wonder what I'm wearing. What's going on today? There's sunlight. I love Edward. He's the most important thing in my entire life, and I live exactly for Edward.
Why is Edward sparkling, even if it's sunny out today?
No, that's too much intellectual thought
right there.
Three blank pages. Three blank pages.
Here's the thing, though. Okay, going back to Blade Runner. Blade Runner was not a success when it was in movie theaters. It wasn't.
No, it wasn't.
Good movie, not a success. John Carter, granted, is not a good movie, but also not a success. And in that sense... That's why I question, is the Western audience ready for those, you know, much more grand, larger science fiction stories? Or do we I don't know.
I guess I wonder, how do you think Star Wars fits into all of this, the original Star Wars?
That's what I was going to bring up, because we take Star Wars out of the equation, then Jen's question becomes a valid question. If we leave it in the equation, it's not. Because Star Wars obviously threw it. Because even no matter what we think of the Star Wars prequels, they made a killing at the box office.
They did.
And a lot of people went to see them, and a lot of people really loved them. We hate them, but maybe that's because we all love the originals, right?
Oh, wait, we're talking about the prequels now?
No. I was talking about the very first, the episode 4, you know?
I'm talking both.
the first Star Wars, episode 4.
There's when it came out, the prequels,
1977?
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, that is a good question. Why was that successful, whereas other films that came around the same time were not? And I can't answer that, unless you're talking lightsaber battles.
My theory is that there was much inside the Star Wars series that was actually easily relatable by your average audience, because it was there was a quality to it that was this World War II kind of plot. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even the battles, the battles between the starships, those were very much handled in a World War II kind of movie kind of way. So he used a language, a vocabulary that the audience could relate to very easily without having to have any background in science fiction to understand.
Yeah.
A guy swinging across a chasm holding a girl in his arms. I mean, that's a pirate movie.
Yeah.
I think John Carter could have done the same thing. I think that in its time, it was using that kind of vocabulary that for that audience, but we no longer drive carriages.
Right.
And so there's a lot that doesn't necessarily translate one-to-one. But you can make it a movie that does captivate the modern audience, and you can put you just have to capture them and put them in the shoes of the hero or the heroine.
Yeah, you just have to be smart about it. And
I mean,
you
have the Hunger Games, and that's, like, pretty smart, honestly.
It is. I've actually been, since I finally read the series in the past 3 days, and I took my kids to watch the first film, and I was, you know, after seeing it, first shocked from just the film that it had gained as much popularity as it had. Two, now that I've read the books, increasingly shocked that it is as popular as it is, especially at the age level that it's popular at, and that so many fundamentalists in this country seem to be kind of washing it by and not paying attention to what it's talking about.
Don't call it to their attention now.
I know, right?
You'll wake them.
It really seems to have kind of snuck in under the radar. And there was, I mean, obviously after the film came out, there were people questioning, you know, some certain aspects of it, but
mostly the race of the character that was black in the book.
Yeah,
I know. And a lot less question of, well, there were some people still going, oh, this is just a fight against the 1%. And you're like, yeah, it really is. And it totally snuck by you guys. I love that aspect of the Hunger Games, but yeah, that's a good point. I'm still trying to figure out how it got as popular as it did. And all I can figure is it's a girl with a bow.
Maybe.
Which is just
It could be maybe some aspect of that the hero is actually a heroine and is not, you know, an urban fantasy tramp stamped with a motorcycle and a sword heroine bending in odd poses. It's a person that we can maybe the teenage girls can actually, you know, connect with on some level.
It's a person that not just teenage girls can connect with. Everyone can connect with Katniss.
Yes.
And that is the secret. You have to have a main character that everyone who goes to see that movie can think, what's she going to do? What would I do in that situation? How is this going to work out? And be actually engaged in it.
Right. Mm-hmm. I've seen the film, but I haven't actually read the books yet.
Oh, go read them.
I have certain issues with the film. I my feeling, I felt very cheated because I felt like Katniss was not actually forced, considering the situation, she was not allowed any agency in on a certain level. Things just magically resolved themselves for her, preventing her from doing anything really evil. But that is a whole nother discussion. But
yeah, read
I just
the
wanna put
book.
Out there. Yeah, I just want to put out there that not all of us are huge fans of the film. It was a good film, but flawed as far as I was concerned. It was a good story, but flawed.
Yeah, when you read the book, a lot of those Deus Ex Machina moments are actually explained. They actually have a little bit more involvement. But I don't think there's any reasonable way they could have translated that into film.
Yeah. No, since a lot of it is very, it's unspoken. And
right, it's in her head. It's assumptions she's making about behavior she needs to show in order for certain outcomes to happen. So,
yeah.
Which they kind of touch on, but yeah. Yeah.
You are right, though, and even in the books, she doesn't, in some ways, she doesn't have a lot of agency throughout the books. You know, there's decisions that she's forced to make that you question right up until the end, you know, if she really has much of a choice in everything. But I think that's actually what becomes so relatable is that it's her circumstances that, you know, sort of create that lack of agency. The fact that she's poor, you know, and there's the ruling class and all those aspects of the story. And I think that's something that, especially in modern America, where, you know, our poverty levels are skyrocketing and whatnot, that becomes increasingly relatable in today's age.
Yes.
I never saw that. I mean, I guess maybe that's why John Carter failed so miserably, is that it's really, he's not a particularly relatable character in the first place. And then you throw him out in Mars, and with, you know, blue-skinned creatures who are riding giant monsters. I don't even know. I haven't watched the film.
Why is it even happening? I mean, why is any of it happening? But if you look at Avatar, which was a giant commercial success,
I hear
people all over the science fiction insider community being like, oh, it's a horrible story. It's so transparent. And it's so pat and so moralist, environmentalist. But the thing is that it actually captures people with something that's pretty and a story that they can actually understand and relate to.
Exactly.
It seems to mirror something that's going on in the world that they actually experience.
Or another movie they've already seen and enjoyed.
Exactly.
That's the white guilt, white imperialist in all of us, I guess. I have big problems with Avatar.
I have a big problem with it too. So you're not
I've never actually seen Avatar.
Don't bother.
I physically am incapable of seeing 3D, and the thing that I heard over and over again was that it's beautiful and you should see it in 3D, and I was like, well, that's never going to happen, so I'll just cross that off the list.
Just see it, if you do see it in the regular, the 3D is pointless.
I honestly believe that a large reason why the film was so popular was because of the 3D element. They were actually immersed in this foreign world, and that was the first time that had actually happened in a movie theater on that scale. And I think that was largely what made it so popular. That, and in addition to the familiar Pocahontas kind of story, but
Wolves, Fern Gully,
whatever.
Name it,
yeah.
It's like it.
I mean, as far as the Katniss thing, just let me, one last little point. I mean, it's not that I have like a huge, huge problem about characters who don't have agency. I mean, if there's a reason for it, that's fine. But that one, I mean, it's something that people should be aware of. When I hear people discuss it, they just feel like Katniss is like this strong female who just makes all the decisions all by herself and blah, 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 blah. When the underpinning is not, does not support that. But back to Avatar.
Well, I actually, before we go back to Avatar, I wanted to say that I've read quite a few of the dystopian YA books that feature young girls as the protagonist, and that is a common thread in all of them. The idea that she doesn't really have, all of her choices are limited, and even when she breaks free of whatever society she's constrained within, she still doesn't really have any choices. It's pretty much whatever the boy of the day tells her she should do.
And I find that problematic. Like,
I definitely find it problematic. I think Katniss is probably one of the better ones. I think she does have more agency than some of the others. But I see a lot of them where it's just like the girl appears to have some agency, but then if you examine the choices she makes, she never actually does.
Yeah.
Which made the ending of the trilogy so somehow completely appropriate and depressing at the same time.
Don't say anything else.
I'm not saying anything
else. Some of us have not read that far.
Oh my god, read that far.
I guess my question would be then, do we consider then the illusory agency to be an even more insidious problem than when female characters don't have agency?
Good question.
Sometimes I'm smart.
Sometimes, not very often, but...
Aww.
I'm just kidding. God.
Hey, I don't know if it's more of a problem. I think it's as much of a problem. And whenever I see it, it reminds me, and I feel like it's actually true for all of us all over the place. We are being handed a lot of things that look like choices but aren't. The thing that most illustrates this to me was an ad I saw probably 10 or 15 years ago. It was a giant poster, and I don't know if you're familiar with the Simon Mall brand, but basically any mall that you go to all across the United States, chances are it is owned by Simon. It is a corporation that owns malls.
Yeah.
And so malls have become more and more alike over the past 20 years because they're all Simon malls and they all have the same stores. And about 10 or 15 years ago, I was in a Simon mall and I saw a big poster on the wall that was for the Simon Mall brand. And it was a picture of a Dalmatian in front of 100 different red fire hydrants that were all exactly alike. And it said, Simon, so many choices.
That's hilarious.
And I was like, they're all the same.
There
also,
is no choice.
Apparently the message that we want to choose, that we want to give you is that you have a ton of choices that are all identical and you should pee on them.
That's like
they're meaningless choices, utterly meaningless choices.
Do you think they were aware of that? Seems like
to think that somewhere there was an advertiser who was a frustrated art major and who slipped that under the radar, and corporate was like, this is a great ad.
Yeah. Although sometimes people don't necessarily think about these things when they do them. I was a graphic designer at Motorola for many years, and there was one particular poster that was a motivational poster that came about during a time when there was a fad about around the imagery from communist Russia.
Oh, God.
That was like fashionable at the time, and a very, I assume, very young graphic designer threw that together without realizing what the message would be. And so there were like all kinds of snarky comments posted on it, and I confess someone close to you now might have added a note that said, work really hard, you might one day earn a refrigerator, and then the poster just vanished.
Well, I mean, it's like, especially if you consider, if you look at malls, you know, every single thing in that mall has been closely studied. It is designed to get you into the stores, you know, in specific stores over other stores. And, you know, the air quality is at a specific level. Signs are designed a specific way. So, yeah, there is that sort of illusory choice that is guided by an unseen hand, you know, lending to the joke that is free will.
Yeah, I mean, and once you're in the mall, you've already lost because
because
you have consented that this is the place that you have to go to buy all the goods that you're going to buy.
Yep.
And I mean, I am victim to this because if I'm going to buy certain things, I'll end up at the mall. I had to buy a dress that I had to wear to a wedding, and there I was in a mall.
And how sad is it that, you know, people are like, I don't even have a mall, because that's me. I don't even have a mall that I can go to. And
you're not missing out. I have a mall. It's awful.
Yeah. I know. Totally.
The only cool thing in there is Tiavana.
Is what?
Tiavana. It's a loose leaf tea place.
Oh.
Oh, nice.
Well, at least they have those in malls now.
But I mean, the thing that concerns me is, you know, when you're to like wrap it around to the topic at hand, we might be risking the danger of sucking out all the life out of sci-fi and fantasy if we say, you know, in order for these things to be popular with your average person, it needs to have relatable bits. I don't think that. I just don't believe that marketing should be the ones to determine what stories are produced or what the story is about. You know what I mean?
Well, but you know, you can be brilliant and you can tell any story well. How do you get Inception? You get Inception because you do a really, really good job telling Batman and make a ton of money. And then the studio says, hey, we'll let you make whatever you want. And then you make Inception. And you know what? That makes a ton of money too, because you're Christopher Nolan and you can tell really good stories with film.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's actually an interesting thing to go into is Inception. I mean, that's a movie that is, you know, it's wildly, I'm totally blanking on a word.
Popular.
Well, it was popular, but no, exploratory,
okay. Experimental.
Yeah.
And yet hugely popular.
Yeah. Because I love it.
But I would argue that it does have relatable parts.
Right.
I would argue that it is smart and complex and relatable, and these things do not cancel each other out.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, you got to recall, like, your main character is someone that commits a crime but only wants to get back to his family. That's something that most people can relate to. They want...
Sure.
You know, if you lost your family, that would be your driving force, too.
So there's the murder mystery of his wife. Yeah. I mean, did she really kill herself, or did he drive her to do it? I mean, there's that whole thing, too. Now, I'm not saying that because there are relatable parts to something that it automatically makes it not worth our while. But I'm just concerned that might be... I am afraid for science fiction and fantasy that it might be Pavlovized. It worries me when you're talking about making something. It's part of the subject that we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
I just want to be clear that when I say that you need to have something be relatable, I don't mean you need to tell the same story every time. I just mean that all the stories that I can think of that are popular and or really good stories are good because they have something in them that speaks to people.
Yeah. Exactly. And that brings me to another subject. I mean, I just taught the ArmadilloCon. Every year I run the ArmadilloCon Writers Workshop. And on Friday we talked about Joseph Campbell, you know, the hero's journey, and everybody's like, look, I mean, not every story needs to fit that template. I mean, this is not something that you should consciously think about. It's something that subconsciously happens. So, I agree with that particular statement. I mean, it's great and beautiful that it's there, but it shouldn't be a recipe for success and that this is what you follow every single time.
No, well, I think honestly, if you set out trying to follow that, you're probably going to come up with a story that seems false.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It shouldn't be a recipe. You know, it's kind of a universal thing that you might end up writing that story anyway, but if it's what you're marking, you know, your plot by, then, you know, you're doomed. My concern is like things, you know, as Julia just said, Inception, part of the reason he was able to do Inception was because he was wildly successful with Batman, which is a straight up, everybody's familiar with its story at this point in time. Granted, he went to darker places than a lot of the public was familiar with at that point in time, even though the comic books had already gone that way. But he had to be wildly successful there before he could go and create a really experimental sort of film that then was popular because of those relatable elements. But, you know, you look at other people who have just done experimental films like Pi and, oh God, what's the freaking director's name that directed Pi? Anybody? Anybody?
I'm drawing blanks.
Oh, no, I can look it up. Let me look
married up. To pretty lady who then went and married Daniel Craig.
Yeah, that's specific.
Sorry, I only have random bits of information in my head. I don't have anything clear or concise.
It's not Darren Aronofsky, is it?
It is!
Aronofsky, okay. Yeah, thank you.
Julia wins.
Thank you.
I was like, I'm coming up with these words that I'm not sure if they're right.
Julia wins.
So he has created these completely, I mean, Fountain is a great example of very experimental sort of storyline, and it has some relatable elements, obviously, in that, you know, the husband trying to save the wife and whatnot, but still, and that's probably one of his more relatable films, which is kind of frightening.
Yeah. Wait, for some reason, I still enjoyed it, though, The Fountain.
Oh, I love it.
It's a beautiful film. It's
beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
Stunning film. Heartbreaking. Yes. Pie, though? Have you guys seen Pie? Anybody?
I've seen Pie. I've seen Pie.
That's a tough movie to
swap. It is a tough movie, but, you know, that was one of his earlier movies, and then he made Requiem for a Dream, which had a bigger budget and had a bigger audience because Pie did get recognized. I've never even heard of The Fountain, but Black Swan was huge.
Yes. Oh, right.
And I still haven't seen that, damn it.
And so you know, it's not a case of you can't make it. If you
didn't
make
like it. Didn't
if you
like
make
it.
Art that has something in it, then you might be able to still get recognized.
Yes.
Right. And a lot of
it's
it though,
just
I mean,
a bigger slog.
There's a little bit of truth to some sort of idea of luck, that some of these people are at the right place at the right time.
Well, that happens in every profession. Every profession.
Right. Right, but I mean, it seems like almost like we're talking about something that if you just do this, that this will happen, like you'll succeed. But there's always that possibility that you could make what is obviously the greatest film ever, and five people would go to the theater and see it.
No, that is totally true. That's why I said it can happen. I didn't say it will happen, because the fact is that I'm an editor. I know for sure that if you're a good writer, if you're writing consistently good material that basically has a working plot and decent prose, and you're not making grammatical errors right and left and having stories that just don't even make sense, chances are eventually, if you're persistent, you will get published. But it's a matter of being really persistent and hitting the right editor on the right day with the right story.
Yeah.
And it is down to persistence, because there are so many other people making stories, and there are so many other stories out there, and there are so many different editors with so many different tastes and moods.
And the editors change almost like every year.
Well, and aside from that, you know, you never know what that editor has seen before they saw your story. Like, If you send the best ever story about mermaids, there is no saying that your editor has not already bought another story about mermaids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even if it's the greatest story about mermaids ever written.
Right. Right. They've already got one. They can't.
We already have one. So.
Yeah. And it's like, if you can publish only, you know, 20 stories a year, and some magazines publish a lot less, then you're not going to want to publish more than one mermaid story. Sure. Or else you'll become the mermaid magazine.
Yeah. And then you'll end up with like a Realm of Fantasy problem, which they became known for having the covers with the
fish boobs.
Yes, fish boob cover, which is problematic on a number of levels, because fish don't have boobs. Let's just get that right. I've never met a fish with boobs.
Okay,
really?
So let's quickly...
No, I've never met a fish with boobs.
Not yet.
Birds,
waiting for that
birds
day.
Have breasts, but...
Well, let's go back to the original question, though.
I want to know what does the question actually mean to you, Sean? Because I have no idea.
You're not the only one. Jen doesn't know either.
I asked him to clarify. I was like, could you clarify question number two for
And I said,
me?
No. No, that's all you need to know.
I was like, okay.
I was coming at it from the perspective that it seems that every single year, in the last few years, and certainly in the last decade, that science fiction and fantasy and the conflation of the two seems to be, not if not the dominant, then slowly becoming the dominant form of storytelling in some capacity or another. That all of the major films, the films that get the most money, the films that get the most advertising, the films that are the most talked about in a sort of general mass public sense, those are the genre films. I mean, you just look at this year. We've got The Dark Knight Rises, which is technically a science fiction film. You have The Hobbit. You have now people, everyone's talking about Cloud Atlas. What else has come out this year? There's other stuff I'm drawing.
You name it, it's probably come out.
Amazing Spider-Man, John Carter.
The Avengers.
The Avengers, Prometheus. Which is huge, right? All of these films, which have very obvious genre elements in them, are just dominating the box office. Even Cabin in the Woods. I mean, just destroying. And I know I'm talking in terms of film because the literary side of it is still somewhat struggling. But that was where I was coming from. At what point, what happens to genre fiction when it is, if maybe the right, is the right word ubiquitous, is maybe I'm the word I'm looking for, that it's so just, that it's so saturated in the market that people don't even notice that they're like, oh, I'm going to go see Transformers 15.
Then something else becomes fashionable. You see, this isn't the first time that this kind of thing has happened. Back when I was a kid,
is that the 1950s?
Oh, piss off, I was now alive. 1950s, screw you! But in the 1950s, Westerns were hugely popular.
Yeah.
They were. Hugely popular. True. And when I was really small, I mean, that was still a phase that they were going through. Everything was a bloody Western. Everything. And then there was like the Dirty Harry phase in like the 70s where everything was some guy who, and that led into the wisecracking action hero kind of thing. I mean, these are phases that we've been going through and we always will. So I'm just saying it's nothing new. It just happened.
I agree. I think that science fiction and fantasy have had a big sort of wave of popularity in the last few years, and we're still riding that, and it's going to eventually ebb, and we'll move on to the next thing, and then something else will be popular.
I just hope that the next thing is still cool.
It won't be.
I can't think of what would
be. Then, and we'll think it's awful, and come on.
Well, I can't help feeling like, you know, welcome to Middle Earth, now go away. But and they will go away, and I'll still be here in Middle Earth, and that's fine. That's fine. We'll just enjoy them while they're here for now.
The question becomes, you know, is how strong is geek culture and how generational is it? So if you've got like a 20-year sort of age break, you know, between say 20 and 40 or so, or even 30 and 50. If that's kind of the age grape, how long will our dollars be the most powerful dollars?
Well, I don't think the dominant age group is really those 30s to 50s.
It's not 30s to 50s.
It's really 20 to 40. The sort of teenagers to those 20s to 30s. Yeah. I mean, that's the real dominant market. And the question is, I guess, in another 20 years, will your kids, Jen, be part of the generation that is also consuming genre fiction like, you know, a crack addict consumes crack? I mean,
I hope so, because it will mean I'll be able to, but I can't answer that. I mean, my kids are weird.
Well, the other thing that I will say is that I don't think that this is going to, it's not like science fiction and fantasy are going to go away.
No.
Even if not every blockbuster is a science fiction or fantasy movie, they're still going to be there. We've had that all throughout the history of film.
Yeah. And to be honest, the saturation at this point, it's the reason that we have some kind of crappy movies like Prometheus.
Well, we've always had crappy movies.
Well,
but
right.
We've also always had good movies, too.
Exactly.
Well,
but
you seem to have a
lot of bad science fiction and fantasy movies.
That's what happens whenever anything's popular, is that there is a lot. And when there is a lot, if you apply Sturgeon's Law, 90% of a lot is still going to be a lot of crap.
Exactly. And then you have Beastmaster. I'm sorry.
Still one of the best ever.
Oh, my God.
I go back and watch that every 2 years. Just
great. Now we're going to have to watch that for torture
cinema. What crappy movies
cinema.
I watched when I was a kid.
See, I want you guys to watch Lady Hawk, because I couldn't believe that Sean had never heard of it.
Right?
Oh, you're kidding. You haven't watched Lady Hawk?
Nope.
Not yet. It's on our list, but it hasn't been voted for yet.
No,
I love that movie. I hate it when people make me watch movies I love and, like, rip them apart.
Love Lady Hawk.
No, it's not next month's movie. It's actually Midnight Chronicle.
Which one? Midnight Chronicle? I've never even heard of it.
It's part of the crowdfunding thing that I'm doing. People that donate $50 get to basically subvert the voting process and choose the movie we have to watch.
Oh my god.
And so we have to do Midnight Chronicle, which looks possibly like one of the worst films we'll have to watch.
Oh my god, that looks horrible.
Just keep muttering, it's not Manos' Hands of Fate. It's not
What do they call it? Like, where they retouch up a movie? What's the process called?
Re-release?
Digitally enhanced, remastered. Yeah, they're remastering it with all of the deleted footage. There's a guy that's actually getting...
Manos' Hands of Fate?
Yeah.
Oh my god. Really?
It's gonna be awesome.
That's terrifying.
But you're strangely curious.
Oh, you are. Don't look at me.
Yeah,
when
don't
you
look
say
at
that.
Us.
No. Everyone in this room is curious.
No.
See, Julia is not about eye bleeding either.
Not that bad. We've watched worse movies.
I like my brain cells. You know, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
I've decided to go with the character from Cheers that says, you know, the whole idea of evolution is, you know, survival of the fittest. So when you drink alcohol, that's why you're smart or something. I forget the whole. You are specifically killing off brain cells, and then that means the only ones that live are the strong ones.
Okay.
So you're actually smarter after you drink. Maybe. Uh-huh. Maybe that's the truth in torture cinema, too.
Oh, goodness.
You didn't hear that bit about, you know, doctor, don't experiment on yourself kind of thing?
Okay, all right. Well, now we're talking about drinking and bad movies, so we should probably close it out. Yeah, but in any case, so if you want to offer opinions, go ahead and do that on the little posty thing, and our information will be at the end. But, of course, our guests should let us know something about themselves, such as where they can be found. So, Julia, where can people find you?
You can find the Outer Alliance podcast at blog.outeralliance.org or outeralliance.podbean.com. And my personal website is juliarios.com. If you want to submit to Strange Horizons, you can do that at strangehorizons.com.
Yeah, all of those are great. Outer Alliance is fantastic. If you're not a member, you should join.
I'm a member.
I know. What does that mean? Even I'm a member.
I don't follow that much, but I actually follow the Outer Alliance. So
yeah, it's very important. So definitely. And check out the podcast. The podcast is good. All of it's fantastic. So, and of course, Stina, where can people find you, Stina?
At www.cslight.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on LiveJournal.
Yeah. Oh, and you've got some sort of big thingy coming up, don't you?
Yeah, that whole WorldCon. Yay!
That she got funding for. Yay for crowdfunding!
Hooray for you guys for sending. Yay! Bless you guys.
Yay! We'll have to meet at WorldCon because I'm going to be there too.
Oh, yay! Definitely. Absolutely. Yep, That'll be so much fun.
That'll be cool. Yeah. And then you can take a picture and you could rub it in our face.
That sounds like a fantastic idea.
I think that's brilliant. Yes, definitely. Let's do that.
Oh, this is going to hurt. There's going to be all these pictures going to my Twitter feed. Yeah.
You aren't here. And if you have the possibility of, you know, if you have a membership in either this Worldcon or the one next year, I believe, you can vote for Hugos and stuff. So, and you should.
Yeah, although the voting deadline is tomorrow.
Yeah, I know. That's why.
So go vote now.
So go vote right now. Right now.
Right. This is going up tonight, so you have time.
you have like a full 13 hours.
You can do it. You can read all that work.
Read faster.
I've already sent in my votes, so I'm totally clear.
Awesome.
Yay! Good on you. You did
spoilers? No, I'm just kidding.
No, don't say it in front of me. I don't want
to
know.
I will not reveal who I voted for to anyone.
See,
sorry, guys.
Good. See, good on you. Good on you. I'm not worried about it.
Cool.
It's an honor to be nominated. Nothing else matters, really. I mean,
you're
really
so lying. Just kidding. I'm kidding.
Alrighty, so that pretty much does it for our show. Thank you both for being on with us at basically the last possible second. We really appreciate it.
Yay!
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, definitely. Have you all? Well, Steen is going to be back, so because she's going to be here for Urban Fantasy. So, but we'll have Julia on again too. We'll figure something out special just for you.
Okay. I'm a little worried now.
No, it'll be...
should have me back as a guest for the torture cinema ones because I secretly adore those.
Okay. Okay.
You can come back for since you watch them voluntarily.
Oh, you're gonna make me come back for Breaking Dawn Part 2.
Part 2.
Oh,
yes.
My
yes.
God. No.
Yes.
Yes. Are you kidding?
Yep. You're set. You're coming back
officially
for Breaking
tagged.
Dawn. Yep.
All right. That's gonna be a fun one because there is so much to. Well, there's usually a lot to talk about in those movies. Exactly.
Yes, indeed. All right, guys. So we're going to get out of here. They're going to go check out Torture Cinema. You're all going to go vote on the Hugos. And I don't know, you'll see us next week or whatever. Something like that. So
exactly. Toodles.
Bye.
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 If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.